Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 17, Feedback 2, Electric Boogaloo. She made me call it that.
You're welcome.
Our last few episodes have generated some emails and comments, so we're going to start there. Since the last time we've done feedback, we've received a pair of new iTunes reviews.
Woohoo!
A total of 10 stars. This one comes from SuperSam75. I recently discovered the family of podcasts that comprise the Relatively Geeky Network. Hey, that's us.
Hey! For a second I thought he said compromise, and I was like, well, that too.
That comprise. I was immediately hooked. Professor Allen and his daughter Emily discussed the issues, storylines, and characters with a true appreciation for the medium. I eagerly await each new episode of Quarterbin, Shortbox, and Uncovering the Bronze Age. The podcast reminds me exactly why I've remained a comic book fan for over 30 years.
Aw, thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
Also, Juice HL reviewed us with another 5 stars saying, came to this family of shows, pun intended. I appreciate that. By way of another podcast where Emily was invited to participate. Since then, I've subscribed to the feed and started from the beginning. I've grown to love all the shows, and the hosts show their appreciation and love for comics. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening.
I'm glad that people are coming to our show from, you know, from other shows that we've guested on together. Is that what he meant? Or are you doing shows on your own?
Maybe.
Huh!
Ungrateful. That's what I am.
Now, it's great with these two iTunes reviews. I actually don't know who either of these people are. I mean, they might be people I know with interesting iTunes handles.
Yeah.
But it was great that our early iTunes reviews were from podcasting colleagues. I remember Charlie Niemeyer and Sean Engel and Chris Tyler and Mike Bradley and others gave us nice feedback in those early days, nice iTunes reviews.
And it was from people that we listened to and looked up to, and not just knew, but people who knew what they were talking about. So that was quite nice.
Now it's nice to have feedback from people who may just be listeners.
Yeah. Random people from the internet.
Which is awesome.
It is.
So thank you, SuperSam75 and JuiceHL. You have boosted my self-esteem appropriately.
Jason Trenner, faithful emailer of the Quarterbin podcast.
Yay!
Sent this show some feedback as well. Hey guys, I figured I might as well start appearing here as well. Better this than me having to go through that pile of Back to the Bins episodes I need to unleash a swarm of emails on. He tells of his one con experience. I got a bunch of comics and trade paperbacks at a local convention on a cold winter's day. After I got my haul, I sat down in the warm lobby of the hotel and read them in a comfortable chair by the fireplace. Not much of a con story, maybe, but that's what I've got.
You know, when we asked for con stories, we asked for everybody's con story.
Yes, and that is a perfectly valid convention story. Several years ago, I spent most of OhioCon in a hallway playing cards. Cons can mean whatever you want to whoever's attending.
I like it. Now, of course, since Jason Trenner's online name is Fanboyamus Prime, he followed up on our licensed character talk with G.I. Joe and Transformers references. They pretty much didn't have to deal with any of that and all, which is a plus of having action figures as the stars. So you don't have to worry about the likeness negotiations in the contracts.
Fair enough.
On the issue of Tolus that Emily reviewed, Jason said, it sounded fun, but I probably need a D20 to really appreciate it.
It was a little bit difficult to explain because so much of that is just description and pretty artwork. I mean, like, it was a good story, but it was a graphic representation of a story from the game table that you would tell your buddy over beers. Not necessarily the most plot-heavy thing in the world. He ends by saying, great show. I'll be checking out more of it. And hope you cover Dream War at some point.
Okay, now I need to explain, Emily.
Please do.
Jason has, shall we say, an obsession with the crossover event Dream War.
We're not going to say passion. We're going to go with obsession.
It's borderline.
Okay. But
I know he has encouraged me to dig through the quarter bins for Dream War crossovers.
Okay.
He's mentioned it to Trentis, I know, probably Michael Bailey, everybody. He wants us to cover Dream War. My understanding of Dream War, it's actually a pretty cool concept. From what I remember of him explaining it to many podcasters and variety of emails, is that it's a crossover between the JSA and the JLA.
Okay.
And they throw in the Legion somehow.
Ooh!
So, you see, it has potential.
Okay!
I'm pretty sure there's some, like, Teen Titans in there, Bob Hope, Jackie Gleason, the 1972 Miami Dolphins.
Globetrotters.
The entire cast of Love Boat. I'm pretty sure Dream War hit just in the era where I was not in comics, so I simply have no frame of reference for Jason's
passion
towards the event.
Okay.
Now, you know, we're a fan of miniseries.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of the concept of a podcast miniseries? Fanboyamus Prime versus Dream War, coming to iTunes soon.
Jason, get on this.
Do it. If no one else is going to do it, you may have to do it yourself. Also referencing our episode on licensed characters, Scott Rifen posted on Facebook, "I've been trying to keep within my comic book budget, but here I am on Comixology looking at Doctor Who the Ripper with my finger hovering over the buy button.
Our evil schemes have come to fruition."
I don't know what else I can add to that.
There is nothing to add.
So it sounds like from the emails and those iTunes reviews that we're getting new listeners to the network, which we're very excited about.
Totally.
And some of those are probably coming from some of the guest appearances we've been on. Back to the Bins.
Superman and Batman.
Just One of the Guys. So we thank those podcasters for having us on as guests, if that's where the new listeners are coming from.
It seems likely. Rare that we're just going to get a random person from the ether.
And one of those new listeners has gone all the way back and posted a comment on Shortbox Showcase Episode 1.
Awesome.
So we're going to deal with that and just throw this out as a comment that because of the nature of this show, we're doing just topics, and very rarely are we talking about specific issues or specific panels or storylines. Feel free, if you're a newer listener and you just, you know, are working your way through the back catalog, to comment on those earlier episodes, even if it's from 3 months ago or 6 months ago or 9 months ago. We're still up for continuing those conversations.
And that's why we pick these topics, is because there is a lot to talk about, and we only really scratch the surface on a lot of these in 50 minutes to an hour of discussion. We actually do think about these things pretty frequently. That's how we get our ideas for topics, is because you just randomly mention something, I push back, and we have a discussion, and then go, oh, we should save that for the podcast. So a lot of these things, it's not particular panels or layouts or a very specific line, you know, they're just sort of concepts that we think about pretty frequently, that they're always kind of fresh in the brain.
So back in episode 1, we talked about the ages of comics, golden, silver, bronze, etc. And we recently got a comment on the blog post for that episode from Noel. And Noel says, "I usually just go decade by decade. Ages can be great conversation starters, but that's also their problem, as outside the Golden Age, they can't be used as easy reference due to always triggering a conversation about what each age means and what it falls into."
Yeah.
There is some truth to that. You know, you're finding that in your Bronze Age show.
Mm-hmm.
That often the first thing you have to do is define what the Bronze Age is.
I think I've defined that in 3 of my 4 episodes that I've been working on thus far.
Billy Hogan, when he transformed the Superman fan podcast into a Silver Age show, he had to determine where the Silver Age started in terms of just for Superman, and he actually came up with 2 separate dates for different runs of comics.
Huh.
So he's got Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane starting at issue 1 as the start of the Silver Age. But his contention was that Superman and Action, the ongoing stories,
mm-hmm.
were still Golden Age for a few more years.
That makes sense.
And so I think it's part of what Noel is getting at, is that there is this wibbly-wobbliness to when one age starts and when one age begins. He continues, "Not only do different titles enter the ages at different times, as I said, but once you hit the 60s, it means different things to the different companies. The Marvel Age was almost its own thing, created as a response to DC's Silver Age." I think there's a lot of truth to that. "And DC's Bronze Age was, in turn, a response to Marvel."
Definitely.
I've mentioned it before, maybe on mic, maybe on a short box showcase, maybe just in conversation, that Marvel, as far as I'm concerned, never really had a silver age in the same way that DC did.
Mm-hmm.
Because DC, with its legacy from the late 30s, publishing superheroes into the 40s and 50s, in essence, entered into the Silver Age as a response to the Wortham hearings and the Comics Code mm-hmm. and all of that. And by the time Stan Lee decided that it was safe for Marvel to get back into superhero comics, some of that had changed, and they were able to do a little bit more modern type of storytelling. So I would contend that they did not have a Silver Age in the same sense of the stereotypical silliness
right.
that DC did. So when DC swerved in the early 70s, it really was a major change. And again, that transition from silver to bronze for DC did, again, take place over a couple of years, mm-hmm. probably.
Definitely. I've been running into that there are different titles that are running the exact same month by the same company. Some of them even have the same creative teams or the same oversight, and they are nothing alike. It's sort of the Wild West in the early 70s. You're just sort of trying to figure out where this crazy train of the comics industry is headed.
Yeah, when you were talking to Michael Bradley mm-hmm. on Superman Batman, he does the segment where you look at all the other comics that were available that month. And I remember in that episode, you were looking at a book from, I don't remember, 72 or 73, Bob Haney and the Super Sons.
Mm-hmm.
And DC was still publishing romance books for a
yep.
little while. They were still publishing some of those really quintessential Silver Age, while Green Lantern and Green Arrow and Batman had been thoroughly bronze-aged, if you will, for mm-hmm. probably 2 years by that point.
Oh, yeah.
So you had this weird transition period. Back to Noel's comment, it's not until the proto-image era of the late 80s, early 90s, that a genuine change defined the entire Marvel line of books. And yet, this is an age that DC largely avoided as, with a few exceptions, they kept that style from defining their line until the New 52. The 80s is hard to define. Modern doesn't work with increasing distance from that time.
Agreed.
Because not only was there bold, mature storytelling, you also saw a steady embracing of the juvenile extremes that would overtake the 90s. I'm definitely among those who would consider the 90s the Dark Ages. Not entirely because of the content, but the almost implosion of the industry as a whole. And thus, as with the Dark Ages, the modern era is a renaissance of sorts. Now, I emailed back to him and said that referring to this modern age as the renaissance, I think, is probably puts a more positive spin on the current state of comics. And he replied to that and just said he was referring to renaissance just as the next step from
yeah.
the Dark Ages.
No, I actually very much agree with this metaphor. I've taken actually a lot of classes about the Dark Ages. I've read up a lot about Dark Age society and how occasionally really dismissive the term Dark Ages is. I really appreciate that metaphor because there is an implosion of structure in the comic industry. Then the types of stories that are coming out change in response to that. But I've heard people use the term Dark Ages, and it's always sounded really dismissive because it sort of has that undertone of, oh, it was the Dark Ages because everything had to be dark and extreme and gritty and it was bleak and awful. And I'm actually taking it more in the metaphor of the historical sense. I might actually be a little bit on board with the modern Dark Age Renaissance metaphor that's sort of building here. I have had issues with that term in the past, but that actually makes it make a lot of sense.
And he points out that part of his argument for Renaissance terminology is that the big two reset their footing and started to rebuild, but also third-party publishers managed
yes.
to find equal footing and maintain popular titles alongside the big two.
Mm-hmm.
Indie comics have seen a swell in popularity that's taken them off the fringes. Digital has brought in new readers for whom local shops might not exist or were unwelcome places to them. Multimedia adaptations have exploded into the mainstream, making once niche characters into household names. It is interesting that 10 years ago, Iron Man, on his best day, was a B-list Marvel character.
Oh, yeah. Let's not even mention Hawkeye. Nobody knew who Hawkeye was. Nobody. I barely knew who Hawkeye was. And then there was a shout out to him in Thor, and then he was a main character in Avengers, and now he's got thousands of Tumblrs dedicated to him, and everybody's getting Hawkeye tattoos, and there's the Hawkeye Initiative, and it's like, it's almost like if you could travel back in time 7 years and tell a bunch of comic book fans, like, hey, by the way, in 2014, Hawkeye is going to be one of the most popular characters with 14 to 21-year-old girls. Everyone's going to go, are you high? That makes no sense. And yet, here we are.
So Noel concludes with, so yeah, there's definitely a whole lot of wiggle room and discussion to be had about the ages, which is why I just stick to labeling them decade by decade. And I think there's some logic to that, except that...
Always except.
As we've said before, when you talk about the 90s, you make sweeping generalizations. You have a negative view of the 90s.
I do.
And of course, the first time you said that, we got an email, I don't remember, Luke Giaconetti or Mike Bailey, yeah,
somebody
listing all the great things in comics from the 90s.
There can be a lot of exceptions to something. And it's still true. I'm just saying.
So, you know, when I'm dismissive of the 90s myself, I don't mean every book from January 1st, 1990 to December 31st, 1999. I mean the stereotypical concepts that were at the forefront during a large portion of the 90s. So I think even decade by decade, you run into these squishiness of when changes have happened.
It's always fuzzy.
It is always fuzzy. Now, we were very excited to get this comment from Noel.
I am going to put in a little correction there. I was very excited about this comment from Noel because Noel is one of the co-hosts of the I Hate Love Remakes podcast,
which is one of our favorite movie podcasts.
It is an excellent show. Whether you hate remakes or love them, you should check it out.
So what the I Hate Love Remakes podcast does is it looks at only movies that have been remade, and they release their episodes in, you know, tandem with each other. So they'll do a discussion of the original Ocean's 11 and then release a discussion of the new Ocean's 11 or whatever the paired movies are. They've done a lot of horror.
Mm-hmm.
Because horror tends to be remade a lot.
Yes,
it does. They've also done some action adventures, Thomas Crown Affair, and various others.
They've also done a good amount of romance, which should not be surprising. If you go to their website, which is actually madeoffail.net, Noel has occasionally written for a very enjoyable column or blog on that site called Straight Guy Reads Bad Romance Novels.
So we're very excited to hear from Noel, and I had to know how he found out about our little podcast.
Yeah, because we might not officially be part of Two True Freaks and the Demonza Corps, but most of our listeners are in that network. That's where we've been doing our co-hosting. So there's
the Mike Bailey, Mike Bradley, Scott Gardner nexus of podcasts.
Right. And so it was just confusing to have an email sort of out of the blue. And I had mentioned Noel's podcast in my third episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age. So I thought to myself, this has to be connected. But how? How did he find us?
So I followed up on that. And you are correct. You mentioned it in episode 3 of Uncovering the Bronze Age. One of the listeners of which was Alexander Adrock, who came to us via, I believe, the Fire and Water podcast.
So Shag's involved in this somehow.
Yeah, he's to blame for many things.
It's 7 degrees of the irredeemable Shag.
So Alexander Adrock listened to the show. He, I don't know if he's a real friend of Noel or just a Twitter friend of Noel, but let him know that he got a positive shout out on Bronze Age, listened to it, sent you some feedback for that episode, and then is working his way through the back catalog.
Which is awesome. This is the great thing about podcasting is that fans and more established podcasters are basically on even footing, but there's still just that little fan wonder of like, oh, Noel knows who I am and likes my show.
So it was fun to get comments from someone sort of outside the comic book podosphere.
Yes.
All right, back to emails. We got an email from another new listener, Hugo Rivera, who sent us greetings from Southern California. I'm a relatively new listener, pun intended.
But I'm Tish.
I subscribed to your feed after listening to Emily in Superman Batman and decided to give your network a try, and I'm so glad I did. After listening to all your shows, I can say that they are great. Professor, your QBP is stupendous. While it saddens me that there are no quarter bins where I live, I feel better knowing that I can live vicariously through you.
Well, that's awesome, because a lot of people are kind of jealous of the fact that we have quarter bins. Or even 50-cent bins.
Emily, your UBA is insightful and illuminating. Most of the Bronze Age stories are via trades, so it's fun to hear your take on something I'm not as familiar with. And I'm not a big fan of Jimmy Olsen either. Represent, Hugo! Booyah!
Seriously, it's not just us.
Lastly, the Shortbox Showcase. I love the fact that anything is fair game. My favorite so far was the sidekick discussion.
Excellent.
And the one with Calvin and Hobbes. As someone who has a collected book with all the Calvin and Hobbes strips, it was fun to hear both of your opinions on it. I, too, will share with my kids when they're old enough to appreciate it. Growing up, I saw myself as Calvin, and now I see myself as the dad. Welcome to my world, Hugo. Funny how that works. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening.
Awesome!
Most of the rest of the feedback is based on episode 16, which was all about sidekicks. So before we get into that big, long topic, let's take a break here, play a promo, and we will be right back.
You've decided to go to a nearby restaurant. You ask the hostess to seat you in a booth. As you sit, you notice an animated conversation among the four seated behind you. They're talking about Star Wars and Doctor Who and something called the Laugh Olympics. These are the people you used to pants in high school, and yet you cannot help listening. Unable to tear your ears away, you realize you've just been sucked into the Dinner for Geeks. Dinner for Geeks, weekly at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. As we said before the break, the most recent episode was number 16, all about sidekicks, and our lovely listeners had some interesting things to say about the topic. Michael Bradley from the Superman and Batman podcast doesn't just send us listeners, he sends us feedback too.
And we appreciate both.
Absolutely. It is interesting to break down the history of, let's call it the sidekick division of the supporting cast portion of fiction. Because whether they be comrades in arms, associate, confidant, sidekick, mascot, a term I loathe by the way, or even love interest, what all the characters you discussed have in common is that they, in relation to the main character or characters, are supportive. My co-host Michael Kaiser and I touched on this somewhat in episodes of Legends of the Batman, while discussing the earliest Batman adventures that included Robin. It's interesting to think just how fundamentally different comics would be had Bill Finger and Bob Kane and Jerry Robinson not introduced Robin. Sure, the idea of sidekicks, and maybe even kids' sidekicks, no doubt would have worked its way into comics. After all, the comics' forefathers, pulp and radio heroes, such as Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet, had their sidekicks on radio long before even Superman made his debut.
I wanted to step in here for a second and say that we totally missed out on radio sidekicks.
I facepalmed when I realized we hadn't even mentioned that.
Because when we were talking in that episode, we went straight from literature, Dr. Watson, straight into comic books. And Michael is totally right to point out Kato and Tonto.
Mm-hmm. But for sidekicks, Robin changed things. From Robin, we got Bucky, Sandy, Toro, Speedy, many Captains Marvel, Kid Flash, Aqualad, and so on. As you pointed out, Jerry Siegel turned the trope on its ear with the Star-Spangled Kid and Stripesy. Supergirl and Batgirl also owe a debt if you trace their existence back to Mary Marvel, and all of them owe a portion of their existence to the possibilities that Robin inspired. I, too, would not classify Jimmy Olsen, in his now traditional usage, as a sidekick in the vein of Robin. He is, however, despite what the professor claims, Superman's pal. Perhaps a discussion for another time.
Let me hop back in here and say that yes, Jimmy Olsen has been around for probably 70 of Superman's 75 years. My snarky comments were mostly related to Jimmy from the Silver Age, late 1950s into the 60s, that era that Billy Hogan covers on Superman Fan Podcast, that Jimmy Olsen is involved in a dysfunctional relationship at best with Superman.
Highly, highly dysfunctional relationship.
As I always say, Jimmy Olsen is Superman's pal in the same way that Lois Lane is Superman's girlfriend.
Not.
Thank you. But back to Michael's email.
But I would argue that Jimmy, too, owes much of his existence to Robin. In episodes of the Superman radio serial, which, shameless plug alert, I covered on an episode of The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, he was very much a sidekick-type character and served the same function as Robin did with Batman. Constant inner monologues are difficult to write, in comics and especially in audio, such as radio. Jimmy gave our hero, in his Clark Kent form, someone to talk to. Jimmy, much like Robin, also provided easy bait for the villains, a familiar face with whom the audience had a vested interest for our hero to rescue. Jimmy, much like Robin, also provided someone to whom the young audience could relate to. His role changed over time, but Jimmy Olsen certainly was a sidekick in the beginning. And again, this sort of goes back to the thing I was saying about how the sidekick role is a very odd place for a character to be in, especially for a long period of time, because I've just always had a very strange perception of Jimmy Olsen, because he is the perpetual teenager. And there's just something kind of weird about that that's always bugged me, because sometimes they play up more that he's childish and has to be protected by Superman, needs Superman's help, Superman's kind of like his dad. Sometimes Superman's more like his big brother, and they're almost like peers. It's just because I think there's no consistent relationship with Superman and Jimmy Olsen, and moreover, there's no, like, arc, I think just really bothers me.
I also think part of that is some of your early DC fandoms were the Legion and Teen Titans.
Yeah.
Both of which showed characters growing up and maturing.
Yeah.
In the case of the Legion, they started off as teen superheroes, became young adult superheroes. There were relationships, marriages, etc. Same with the Teen Titans. Obviously, in that case, you literally have Robin growing up and becoming Nightwing.
Yep.
So that's sort of your template for how comic book teens should grow into young adults and adults. And Jimmy is sort of constantly pigeonholed in this one category.
Yeah. So he sort of falls in the same category with Roy Harper / Speedy for me, that I almost feel bad for him. I just like Roy more as a person. With Roy, I can actually feel bad that he's just stuck in this infinite loop. With Jimmy, I tend to roll my eyes more. He's just not as likable of a character, guys. He just isn't. But on a positive note, Michael still says that he is enjoying the shows and looks forward to more relatively geeky goodness.
Thanks, Mike. He does add a P.S. I have not seen Sky High, but I've seen many episodes of The Simpsons, Emily Zero, Me One, to which I replied, Mike, I'm not sure what kind of crazy math you're doing, because you not having seen Sky High makes the score 1-1.
Booyah!
Speaking of Michaels, we also got an email from
Michael Bailey.
From many podcasts. Let's just say here, Tales of the JSA and Views from the Long Box. M. Bailey points out, as did M. Bradley, that Robin came first. It's possible we may have implied that Bucky came first.
Yeah, I have only read like 5 issues from the Golden Age, so I've got a slightly skewed time scale.
He also wanted to stick up for Stripesy, adult sidekick of the Star Spangled Kid. One of you said it was creepy to have the kid as the hero and the adult as the sidekick, but to me, it was all kinds of awesome. Pat Dugan was not so much sidekick as the guy there to keep Sylvester Pemberton out of too much trouble. He was the kid's driver, so probably had a protective relationship with the kid. So it wasn't creepy at all.
To be fair, we did point out how handy it is for a kid hero to have an adult partner or sidekick. Talking about rental cars, credit cards, hotels, general adult supervision.
And I think I was just being purposely over the top by reading a modern creepiness angle into the relationship. That was totally not intended.
Yes, it was not meant in any sort of even really seriousness, let alone spite. And now with the context of what M. Bradley was talking about in the previous email, Stripesy is sort of more like Tonto or Kato, that he is the sidekick who's there for emotional support and actual, like, aid. That, like Kato, he's the driver and the bodyguard.
Right.
That is a totally valid base core identity for a sidekick, you know. Going back to our quibbles that we had with the ranked tree for sidekicks, I would say that Alfred is more a sidekick than several of the mascots that ended up on that list. That
you can say Snapper Carr. You can call him out if you need to.
Okay, Snapper Carr should not have been on there. Okay. Alfred should have been. Because Alfred is closer to being a sidekick than Snapper Carr. And I think that then Stripesy is one step further. That he has the sort of paternal mentor,
right,
aid, assistant sort of role that Alfred does. But he also does help back up the kid hero in fights.
In terms of fully closing the loop, we shouted out in that episode to Longbox Graveyard and the votes that he was doing, his final four ranking and so on, in interest of not leaving our listeners hanging. Bucky won 53% to 47%.
Really?
In the finals over Robin. I suspect if a Captain America Winter Soldier movie was not out at the exact same time, the results may have been slightly different.
Slightly.
But the people have spoken.
The people have spoken.
We also got an email from Mark Adams from Northern Ireland. He is Mark's Mess online. He's doing a podcast miniseries on the Evolutionary War, a Marvel event from many years back. He puts out about an episode a month and has done, I think, 9 episodes so far, with not too many more to go. They run 30 to 40 minutes each, so it's very easy to get caught up on. Search Evolutionary War podcast, and it'll come up. He wrote to us, "Great show about sidekicks. It did put in mind some comedy superhero sidekicks. The UK comedy duo have God with the sidekick of BMX Boy, just showing the complete inequality of the power scale in that relationship."
I have actually heard of God and BMX Boy. You were a little bit baffled, I will say, by this, that you were just like, what? Huh?
I'm familiar with all of those words, but not in that combination.
Not in that sentence. But yeah, I like God and BMX Boy. I've seen like one or two of the skits thrown around YouTube, various places, that BMX Boy has a whole plan. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to ride my BMX bike and we're going to go up over this ramp and then I'll pull a triple double back axle over under flip. And then you come in and God just goes, well, why don't I just smite him? Well, you could do that, but and he smited. Which is, it's funny. It's very funny. And does bring up a legit point that if you're going to have a sidekick superhero duo, you need to make sure that their powers are, if not a not necessarily equivalent, but are at least on the same power scale.
Something more like Superman and Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah! It's not a sidekick! They're not even on the same... Okay, we've already talked about Jimmy. Let's move on.
Flash and Kid Flash.
There you go. Similar powers, but one is slightly less powerful, less mature. There you go.
Mark continues, "We also have Orange Man and Apprentice Boy Wonder. Trust me. If you were from Northern Ireland, you'd be chuckling now, but some specific humor just doesn't travel."
I've got nothing on that one. I am not from Northern Ireland.
Mark does, however, proclaim his love for Rick Jones, who we first came across in the pages of Excalibur 14, when the team was trapped in a comedy version of the 616 universe. Rick Jones was just looking to be the sidekick to anyone. But I guess one man's sidekick is another man's annoying person who just won't leave him alone. Keep up the good work on all three of the podcasts. Thank you, Mark.
And he also brought up a question that we'd sort of kicked around a little bit but didn't actually address on air, which was this. Do you think that Marvel benefited from fewer sidekicks than DC?
And I commented back to him is that sidekicks are like capes.
Mm.
DC has a lot more of both.
Yep.
For good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, again, it relates to the fact that DC was the active publisher in the late 30s and 40s and 50s when sidekicks and kid sidekicks were all the rage. So every character had to have one. Where by the time Marvel was coming around in the early to mid 60s, some of that had changed a little bit. and they were able to basically enter without having that 25 years of baggage that DC had.
They didn't have that, well, we'll just say it now, an outdated trope that was common during the Golden Age and thus somewhat overused and abused in the Golden Age. And then when Marvel got their start, they were able to start fresh and decide, let's just not.
And one of the advantages of the kid sidekicks was that it gave, you know, the 8-year-olds who were reading the books someone to identify with.
Right. And this brought up something that I thought might be connected to this, which is sort of a two-pronged point that the readership for Marvel seemed to be at least slightly older. Now, a lot of this is being drawn from the Fantasticast coverage of Fantastic Four in the now mid to late 60s. And in the letters pages, it talks frequently about fraternities and campus clubs and even, you know, high school associations, and that those sorts of mid to late teen groups were sort of the start of the Mary Marvel Marching Society, of having an official fan club for the company. But that was because people in this age range were already sort of forming their own groups. And then they're like, well, we might as well make it official and sell merchandise. That was interesting. But then another thing I realized was during the time of the Jimmy Olsen books, where you were relating to Jimmy Olsen as a way to relate to Superman.
Right.
During that time, Spider-Man, same age as Jimmy Olsen, hero in his own right.
And of course, Human Torch in Fantastic
Johnny
Four.
Johnny Storm of the Fantastic Four. That Marvel never had, I wouldn't say like an issue with, but it's like Marvel seemed more comfortable having teen and young adult heroes than DC did. Again, because DC had its own sort of fixed continuity that any characters who might have been in their late 20s, because I think Superman was supposed to be like
26 to 29
maybe when he was first created, that he was post-grad, that he was not in college, he was working. I always sort of felt it was implied that he had recently graduated, that he'd graduated maybe 3 or 4 years earlier and was only like 26. But by the 60s, everyone sort of accepted that Superman was about 30 to 32. And so since they already had those established characters that had history, they had sort of aged them up slightly.
Right.
And they just didn't seem to be making as many new characters in the 60s, whereas that came more in the 70s, that there were the creation of new characters. You know, of course, that is a mass oversimplification, that there was the 60s update of all of the Golden Age characters,
right,
and then that kind of stuck for a while.
So I think DC ended up with adult heroes and kid sidekicks, where Marvel ended up with some kid heroes.
Right.
And, you know, the X-Men.
Exactly, yes.
Were high school age.
Yeah.
Barely out of high school.
Jean Grey was like 16 or something.
Right.
I think the oldest was Scott, who was like 20. Marvel either just didn't have, you know, as you've said before, just didn't have the baggage. I don't know if they were just more comfortable with it. They just embraced that aspect.
And there, you know, there might be a which came first.
Right.
Did Marvel end up with a slightly older audience because they had heroes that were closer to those ages?
Yeah, or did they create the slightly younger heroes to relate to the older demographic?
And then, yeah, which came first? Did the heroes of that age come first, or fans of that age come first? But Marvel, you know, was able to even more closely relate to their audiences, you know, by not just having sidekicks that you could identify with, but having heroes that readers could identify with. So it probably wasn't until like the mid-70s version of the Legion and the 80s version of the Teen Titans that DC really caught up with that particular trend.
That I absolutely, absolutely agree with. Because the 60s Legion was basically a Jimmy Olsen book. That it had that sense of silliness and randomness. And it was, I think, better because you didn't have that weird age power dynamic going on where you were relating to a character who was relating to a character much older than him, and he just sort of feels like a proxy.
Right.
Whereas with the Legion, it was the Legion and Superboy, that at least the team up, as it were, was of people of the same age.
But right.
That didn't start really taking itself seriously until the mid-70s, and Teen Titans was silly.
Yeah, certainly it. I mean, Teen Titans was a Bob Haney joint for a while.
Yes, it was.
So it was silly, really,
it was very Haney.
And it really, you know, really wasn't until the Wolfman Perez run that really took a serious upturn in terms of the quality of the writing,
and again, upped the ages slightly. That
right,
looking in the 60s, all of the kid sidekicks are around 14 to 15, whereas in the Wolfman run, they're all sort of 16 to 19.
Yeah, maybe in college age or just out of college.
Just out of college or getting ready to go to college.
On the verge of adulthood or young adulthood at least. So I think that just made a different type of reading experience.
Yeah. And as someone who was very recently in that stage of life, it's very important to have those sorts of heroes that are near your old age but just slightly older. Because you are going through those weird rebellious phases where you're annoyed by children and you don't want to listen to adults. Like, you really only care about people that are a year younger than you or 4 years older than you.
Well, they say that's the secret to this explosion in young adult novels.
Yep.
In the last decade or so.
Just going to bring that up. The wonders of Tamara Pierce.
And... yeah. The secret of that is that you pitch your lead heroic character to be 2 or 3 years older than what you expect the demographic to be. So this character can be a motivation or an inspiration to you.
And that's an important thing for kids to have, which, to be honest, they weren't getting at DC, so they went to Marvel.
Yeah, and
the wonders of free market economics.
Yeah, so these characters were more aspirational than the ones that DC had at first. And it took DC a little while to catch up with that. So, winding back around to Mark's question,
yes.
Do we think that Marvel benefited from fewer sidekicks than DC?
I would say, in a very short, concise, simple answer, yes. In that it made Marvel stand out, that it made Marvel a unique and distinct alternative to DC. I mean, this is why, 40 years later, we have Marvel versus DC, that the two companies, even just taking a divergence, young adult tie-in, just something that would seem so small of, should we have sidekick? And just saying no actually did help it to become a very different style of storytelling, a different universe, have a different feel, different focus, so that it's not like you were getting the same thing if you went to Marvel. Like, that's why people were drawn to it. I would say yes, but I also would say that DC was not hurt by its sidekicks. It made DC uniquely DC.
I think this topic is one of many where you can see the divergence between Marvel and DC. And simply, as you were referring to, free market economics a few minutes ago, giving customers more options, more choices, so they aren't just carbon copy universes, carbon copy stories. In general, I think that's a good thing.
I agree. If only to give an alternative in the medium and show that comic books don't all have to be capes and sidekicks. It can be something different. It could be teenagers in spandex leotards and eventually Spawn and Walking Dead, and it can be Planetary. It can be Fables. It can be Sandman. It can be all sorts of things. Anything that gives us fuel for our comics is not a genre fire, that's good.
We like superheroes.
We do.
We like superheroes and other stuff, too.
Indeed.
Well, that is the bottom of the feedback pile, but we did want to talk a little bit about what we've got coming up. We are recording this the day before Free Comic Book Day.
Woo!
And it will come out a few days after Free Comic Book Day.
So, I hope you went to Free Comic Book Day in the past. I was going to say, you should go to Free Comic Book Day in the past, but it's not up to you anymore.
And to engage in some shameless self-promotion.
Always.
The comics at Free Comic Book Day, how much do they cost?
Oh, I think nothing.
Is that less than 25 cents?
I believe it is.
So, as of the release of this episode, the next episode of Quarterbin Podcast will be about the books that I got at Free Comic Book Day. And when I say I got at Free Comic Book Day...
You mean I got.
I mean the books that Emily got at Free Comic Book Day, because she's actually the one that's going.
Yep.
The store that Emily's going to in her college town is about an hour away from us, And the store that has the quarter bin deals is about 30 or 40 minutes the other direction. It is the town that I work in, but with final exams and summer coming, I'm not going to be visiting campus as much the next few months.
Yeah.
So we will be somewhat without an LCS. The L part might not be as appropriate.
Yeah, it's not very local.
But in addition to Free Comic Book Day, around mid-May will be the next batch of quarter bin sales.
Yeah!
So the way that that store works is they don't have the quarter bins out all the time. I don't know if that is an implication from my podcast, but the way it works is they do have dollar bins out all the time.
Sometimes 50-cent bins, maybe two or three 50-cent bins.
Quarterly, they do the quarter bin sale, and they bring out 25 long boxes.
Something like, just fill the store with long boxes.
Of super cheap comics, almost all of them from the 1990s.
Huh, weird.
I do have an opening in the quarter bin schedule for a Marvel. So the first Marvel that I find, I'm going to pull, and that will be, I think, episode 31 or 32. And then I'm always on the lookout for various Dream War tie-ins.
Apparently, that's our new thing. I want to read Dream War now. Go find me some Dream War.
Sorry, Jason. I don't think we're going to find any there. So that's what we have going on. Free Comic Book Day and then Cheap Comic Book Week.
Awesome.
The LCS that does the quarter bins does actually not participate in Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah.
It's probably because 25 cents is about as cheap as they want to go.
To be fair.
That's not too outrageous.
Nah. So you can get 25 cent comics four times a year or free comics once a year.
I like the approach they have.
It works.
So thanks again to everybody who sent us an email, Facebook comments on the blog posts. Thanks to everybody, old listeners, new listeners, veteran listeners, rookie listeners, we are glad to have you.
You can find this episode and any of our other episodes at our website, relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. If you have feedback, then you can contact us through Facebook and the website, but also through our email, which is relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Check us out in iTunes, leave a rating and review if you're interested, and if it's nice.
Emily was recently a guest on episode 110, I think it was, of Just One of the Guys.
It was.
And Sean Engel debuted the world premiere of the Shortbox Showcase promo.
Now, I admit my bias, but this is one of the 10 best promos I have ever heard.
It's not as good as the Fantasticast.
Nothing is.
But it's still pretty good.
I will take coming in sixth to the Fantasticast.
I think that's fair. So we're going to put our promo at the end of this episode. No outtakes or funny stuff like that. We're going to drop our promo in here. We're also going to put it on the website and in the podcast feed separately. And we encourage and ask our podcasting friends to drop the promo in. I think we've explained it before, but when we started this whole idea, it was going to be the quarter bin and uncovering the Bronze Age as the main driving forces. So we did promos for those two shows. And this was going to be the whenever we get around to it cast.
And then this is the one that everybody likes and I can actually get off my butt and record.
So it took 9 months.
Something like.
But we finally have a promo featuring the combined talents of you, me, and Luke Giaconetti. Enjoy. Thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.
This is an imaginary podcast, which may never have happened.
The Shortbox Showcase.
But then again, may have. About a father and daughter. I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily.
Who came from Ohio and talked about comics.
Walking Dead.
Tintin.
Black Lightning.
White Tiger. It tells of their rise to glory, when the great guests were yet to be booked.
Let's put it this way, Shogun Warriors wasn't going to win any Eisners.
And the great feats of editing not yet performed.
This is Ultra 7, this Ultraman Jack, and this Ultraman Taro, and this Ultraman Leo, and this
of how they spoke at length.
Continuity is really the brainchild of nitpicking nerds the world over.
But to be fair, the best kind of confession is the Force confession.
And reviewed in brief tales that explore creatively the bounds of a given character's history.
Red Sun is wonderful with a very strange ending.
Of brilliant creators before their fall from grace. This is the era where Miller is at the height of his creative and artistic powers, and the ability of strong writing to encapsulate and transcend its time.
Flash of Two Earths by Gardner Fox.
This is an imaginary podcast. Aren't they all? Shortbox Showcase is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Check us out on the web at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search in iTunes for Relatively Geeky or Shortbox Showcase. And remember, we're not experts.
We're just family.